This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
This is gorgeous here. I mean, this is all new to me.
Baz Nichols is a writer who is intrigued by lost and hidden landscapes. He's published a journal called Echtre, featuring his own work and work from other writers who are also fascinated by such places. I'm Helen Needham, and in this edition of Scotland Outdoors, I take Baz to the Forvey National Nature Reserve on the Aberdeenshire coast, a place I think he would find moving.
The only thing I know about Forvey is that it's a sanctuary for nature, it's a nature reserve, but also within the area of the nature reserve there is the remnants of the old village of Forvey, which was submerged with sand. Can't remember the exact timeline for that, but it was a long time ago, I think possibly medieval, and slightly beyond. So underneath, roughly from where we're standing, there's this village, and that really kind of resonates with me and with the subject matter that I write about, really, lost and abandoned landscapes.
I'm so pleased that we finally met up, because we've been communicating. Yeah. And you've been moving up here after a busy life in the south. I'm intrigued to know why it is that you particularly feel attracted to places, these lost and hidden landscapes.
A lot of it comes from my youth. I was born in 1960, so 15 years from the end of the war, and I was born in a part of East London that kind of bridges the borderlands of Essex and Hertfordshire and the city. That area of East London at the time still carried a lot of the scars and blemishes of the war. So as a kid, I was really drawn to these marginalised places, kind of edge lands and bombed out factories and things like that, that were still really in recovery from the end of the Second World War. So I think, looking back at that, I think that must have had an effect on me creatively and psychologically. And it's only really started to manifest in the last 15 years or so, creatively, writing-wise.
And then you had a particular experience where you discovered a place near where you lived in Northamptonshire that really kind of triggered off your whole perspective, really, on life and the landscape.
Yeah, definitely. I'd been writing for many years, not in any particular way, and then one day my wife and I and some friends were travelling back from a country fair, and our road got diverted onto a small road about 2 miles from where we lived, and we saw the remnants of an old church buried in the landscape. So I immediately thought, right, let's go and have a look. Went to explore this church, and it was the old church of St John in Boughton Village, or what was Boughton Village, which was literally 2 miles from my house, but I never knew anything about it. And when I passed through the gates, the energy changed. It felt like moving from one world to another. It was like walking through a portal, really. It was something that changes in me mentally, something where you you feel like you've slipped into another world, another dimension. And repeated visits to it reinforced that sense, really. And I started to go to the local county records office and discovered that it had once been quite a significant place of healing. The Pope at the time actually acknowledged it as a place of healing. And there was a holy well beneath it, which is still there, but fairly dried up now, that was actually hugely important at the time. So this place that was really not acknowledged in my locality by anyone, really, suddenly became hugely significant. And I realised that there were these layers of history that we didn't really know much about. So I started to collate some of that information that I'd found at the records office and compiled it along with some more kind of poetic and impressionistic work that I call incantations, that really kind of summoned some of the energy of the place for me and really encapsulated what it was. So yeah, that started the current journey of writing, really, and the current thread of being interested in lost and marginalised places, and the fact that there are huge numbers of places, particularly in the British Isles, but all over the world, that have kind of slipped through the cracks of history, and places that were once significant and enjoyed some status can suddenly become forgotten and no longer acknowledged or no longer recognised. So I think there's something really important about that, and acknowledging it and bringing these places to the surface again, albeit in a literary fashion or a poetic fashion, and kind of giving them a polish and some kind of new life, and applying my imagination to that as well and kind of making it resonate again is hugely important to me and to the people that read my work. The moor is a mirror, an earthen sea ablaze with brilliant emerald stars, and peach-oaked sullen meadows burst in the bruise of night, their words and whispers lost in mirror pools, and each dark reflection scaled with liquid forms like hidden language. Now sentient walls glow honey brown on rutted trails, clefts and corries, all scored like wounds in moorland flesh. I mark my way with gifts of roots and seeds and wings of feathered things and salt and lead, borne on the wind, washed up from parched channels amongst the clustered tongues of ferns and on those barren shores the dust of slate. Only here lies my salvation, my way home. So that was really a piece that was taken from an amalgam of all the moors that I've ever visited, not one moor in particular. But then at the end of that, I write about kind of a distillation of where that comes from. I love the flowers of the British moorlands. Their scent is my guide through the moor's nameless precincts. Their roots are dendritic pathways downwards, backwards in time, each stratified layer leading us further towards its tenebrous primeval woods. These species speak of forest, of wolf, of lynx and bear, their bones still interred deep beneath the peats and bogs, a whisper of breath from lives long absent. And scattered across the moor like lost constellations, we find dark, rocky outcrops, tors and crags, survivors of the last ice age, sown like glacial seeds. Woven amongst them, the revenants of human activity reach across epochs. Bronze Age cairns, disused leadworks, Roman settlements, medieval villages, abandoned tin mines, all cluster the moors as each age of occupation elides and assimilates, a cachet of memory.
And it's interesting because this is a sort of mixture of fact-finding and the imagination as well.
Yeah, I think there's a synthesis of the two that threads through everything that I do, really. So I do like to acknowledge what's known of a place historically and give it some historic credibility, but also add into that mix my more kind of poetic or impressionistic sense of it. And it's what I call dowsing. It's a kind of a form of linguistic salvage, if you like, some way of acknowledging the energy of a place and what it does to us as people, how it resonates with us. And places resonate with people in very different and varied ways. Some people will document a lost place or a forgotten place in totally straightforward academic form. I like to kind of mix it up and make it more poetic and perhaps a bit more romantic, if you like.
You say the moor is a mirror. You are relating that environment, which some people might look at a moorland. They're very interesting places, actually, because some people might look at them and think, this is bare, empty, there's nothing happening here. But actually, when you start to spend time there, you start to realise that there's so much going on.
Absolutely. And that's the beauty of the moor, isn't it? I think because, again, one could look at these vast expanses of apparent nothingness, and then when you start to look inwards, downwards, and look more closely and spend time and inhabit that landscape and get a sense of its moods and its changes, its wildlife, the sky, the movement of water through it, all of these things suddenly start to take on an energy. And that energy for me is a spiritual energy that's within all of us. But I think if you kind of meditate on a place like a moor, which is a relatively undramatic landscape, but it has drama within its fields, if you like, for me it does become a mirror. It's a mirror in the sense of its physicality. It's scarred, it's pitted, it's imperfect, like all human beings are. But also it's a mirror in the sense of spiritually it's a mirror. It's something that should resonate with all of us, and it has this kind of magic to it, particularly when you spend time. And I think to really get to know a landscape, you have to spend time with it and get to know its moods, and it gets to know you. And as it gets to know you, it reveals more of itself.
Yeah, that's interesting that you see it as a two-way process, actually. It's
Definitely. Not
you just perceiving that landscape, but the landscape has a character, a soul, a spirit of its own.
Well, yeah, look at where we are now. We're out now in the middle of almost scrubland heath landscape, but I guarantee you now that there are eyes upon us. There's one up in the sky there. There are eyes upon us, whether we can see them or not, whether we can sense them or not. Being out now in this feels quite eerie, don't you think?
Yeah.
So there's that sense that there's an energy here, there's something here, and it's quite a public space. There aren't many people, in fact, there's hardly anybody around today. But there's something in the breeze, there's something that I sense here. And I think if I came here at dawn or dusk, there would be a different energy, a different feel to the place. And it's that energy that I kind of try and douse and try and get down into my notepad, which I always have with me. I get these sense impressions. And as soon as you start to assemble those things, a narrative emerges and words come almost unbidden, really. And I feel that that's the land speaking. Obviously, I'm the vector, I'm the vehicle through which it communicates, but this probably sounds really corny, but it does. For me, there's that sense that the land is speaking in a certain way, with a certain mood. And that's kind of the poetry of it, really. You hear these voices and interpret them as the land. They're obviously an amalgam of you and the land together. You're giving the land some voice. We were talking earlier about this sense that when people are facing or have an encounter with ancient stones, particularly stone circles, the first impulse is to touch them. And I think there's a poetry to that, but there's also a spiritual reason why we want to touch this ancient stone. It's to sense that vibration, this echo from our past. And touch something that we know ancient hands have touched, and to make a connection across time and space with people that are our ancestors. And it's common to all of us. You see it all of the time. I visit lots of standing stones, stone circles all around the country. It's one of my passions. And I see it everywhere. People just touch the stones and even hug them. One of the things that fascinates me is that nature always manages to reclaim whatever humans build when they go into decline, nature recovers and reclaims very quickly. And that's probably a cliche, but it's true. So I think that's hugely important. And the fact that this is a nature reserve as well makes it incredibly powerful.
And that's actually quite a common occurrence, isn't it, within places, hidden, forgotten landscapes, post-industrial landscapes and so on, that they end up being havens for nature.
Definitely. And I think one of the things for me, particularly at this time now, is that these things are happening right in front of us. I mean, there are buildings, there are parts of towns that are being flooded and washed away. Now more than ever, it's more important to record these places before they disappear. The British coastline is eroding really quickly. If you go down to the east coast around Lowestoft, around Norfolk and around there, the ancient town of Dunwich sank into the sea, much like Forvey here has. Although Forvey's been submerged by sand rather than sea. But these are all forms of erosion. They're all forms of nature reclaiming. And I just think it's a mission of mine to try and write about it as much as possible and make it interesting to people again so that they take notice of what's in front of them, what's beneath them, what's actually beneath their feet. British Isles particularly, we have these incredible layers of history on our doorstep and juxtaposed against each other. You can be on a Bronze Age burial site and 500 yards up the road you have a military pillbox from the Second World War, and then a few miles from that an ancient Roman encampment. So there are all these kind of incredible layers of history right nearby, and we need to celebrate that.
Yeah, and is there any kind of sense of nostalgia at all coming through this? Or what is it? What's the sentiment?
That's an interesting question. I think there is nostalgia. I think it encompasses personal loss as well. When you've lived as long as I have, you see people and places go by the wayside quite quickly. Your life changes dramatically. And I think recording those changes is quite important, really, and also preparing for the next generations, letting the next generation know how important these things and these places are, and how the natural world might affect their lives as well in the same way.
Because obviously we're living very much in an age where there is very much more a focus on climate and change and climate change.
Yeah.
Is that intrinsic within all of this?
Yeah, I mean, life is change, isn't it? Everything's change, everything moves, everything shifts, nothing ever stays the same. And again, there's that sense that there are layers, there are strata to the world. For instance, any turn of an archaeologist's spade could reveal something that we've never known before, right beneath our very feet, right beneath your very feet. And also the fact that now you've got massive glacial retreat, you've got the ice caps that are rapidly in retreat, and they're revealing artifacts and things that about places that we never knew before. So there's these huge layers of history, again, that we know nothing of. Doggerland I've written about quite comprehensively, another submerged landscape, a place that is lost to history. We know nothing of it, we know nothing of its people.
Well, we'll just talk about that, because when I got a glimpse of the sea there, I thought, oh, we must talk about Doggerland. What is Doggerland? What was Doggerland?
So Doggerland has sometimes mistakenly been referred to as a land bridge that used to exist between England and France. But fairly recent barometric evidence suggests that it was much bigger than a land bridge. It was actually a land mass that went as far up as the bottom end of Denmark and as high up as perhaps Northumberland, even the bottom end of Scotland. So it was a huge landmass, in archaeological terms, relatively pristine. And the artefacts that have been dredged up from it over the last 100 or so years have proved that there was a race of people living there. Where they ended up, we don't know. So it could be that they drifted out to the east coast of England or to the west coast of France. We just don't know. So again, that's fascinating for me, is that there's this layer of history that we know nothing of, buried under the sea. And because it's buried under the sea, it should probably be preserved forever. So it's a rich ground for a writer such as myself to write about it poetically and imaginatively.
And is there a lot of mythology surrounding Doggerland?
Yeah, I think there is, and I think there's a lot of speculation as well. It's relatively blank canvas, but there are people at the University of Birmingham now that are actually seriously researching it topographically, but also historically. Unfortunately, the oil industry and dredging and various other industries have upset the seabed itself, so those artefacts have become slightly muddled. And again, that's quite rich ground because it mixes up these, again, the layers of history that are submerged beneath the ocean. So it's a quite a tricky one, I think, archaeologically to pick apart. But poetically, happy days.
Yeah, rich pickings for you.
Absolutely rich pickings, yeah, it's perfect. I've also written about other submerged landscapes around our coasts. There's Cantre Gwaed, I'm not sure I've got the correct pronunciation there, off the coast of Wales, where there are remnants of a submerged forest. A place called Corley or Corlia in Ireland, where there was supposedly a land bridge between Ireland and the British Isles.
That's funny given the contemporary context of the desire for a land bridge.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And you know, again, these things can be brought into sharp relief, and these are things that we should start to recognise the first signs of now. You know, there are theories that our coastline's rapidly eroding so quickly that much of what we know as the British Isles will, in the next few hundred years, be completely submerged again, and we'll be an island race in more senses of the word. We'll be living on islets instead of one continuum. So again, you know, I think there are ecological messages in there.
Well, it's interesting, these places that you describe, they're not always beautiful places, are they?
No,
and
far from it.
Some of the other writers, that it's not always about the sublime, is it?
No, definitely not. We're not talking about Arcadia or Atlantis. These are generally bland, mundane places, which is possibly part of the reason why they become marginalised. They become forgotten because they're not attractive, not beautiful. But they tell a rich part of our story. Jeff Young particularly strikes me because he writes about 17 trees on an edgeland part of Liverpool where he lives, and it's something that he gains some kind of spiritual energy from. Sometimes these things are intangible, these feelings, these senses are intangible. Why do sacred places become sacred? You know, there's a reason for it, there's a resonance, there's something within the context of that place that makes it special to somebody. And I think that's, in some sense, very subjective, but also, perhaps, taking a wider perspective, the more people that take notice of it and acknowledge it, the more it gains momentum and importance. And again, I think that's part of the reason why we're writing about places like this, because it gains momentum. It kind of energises people to go and have a look themselves.
So do you think this might be a place that you'll come back to, then?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's 15 minutes from where I live, so why wouldn't you? I'd really want to find the village, or at least stand where the village once was, and see what that brings in terms of inspiration for writing. But yes, beautiful landscape. The colours, it's all quite muted, quite desaturated today because there's no sunshine. But it's still got this kind of beauty. It's got the beauty of a moorland.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? There's quite a lot of heather, but there are also these variety of little flowers peeking out there too.
Yes, fantastic. It's like a wonderland. It's only when you really start to sense it and you use every sense, the tactility, the smells and the aromas, the movement, everything, the lights, you know.
One of the things I like about this landscape is the way that the grass moves in the breeze.
Yeah, and there are many textures of grass there as well. It's kind of the very fine stuff that's very atomised looking, and then the more robust and obvious grasses as well, and the different colours and hues of the stalks, etc.
So when you come back here, possibly alone, to do your dowsing,
yes,
as it were, would you sit down in the landscape? What would you do?
I walk, and then I think, like anything, your sense draws you towards a place that particularly resonates, sometimes consciously, sometimes not so much. So I very often, when I walk, particularly in a more remote or bleak place, I kind of willfully get lost, and by getting lost you kind of go off the map slightly, and you can find, not every time, but you can find rich pickings, creatively and spiritually. And sometimes these things can happen right in the middle of a town as well. You know, I've done urban walks and found some incredible places that are off the beaten track, places that are, as you said earlier, not particularly attractive or not particularly appealing, but they draw you for some reason. So again, that kind of stuff really resonates with me. It really gives me energy.
And then you maybe find out afterwards that there was something that had happened there, or...
Yeah, that's part of the incantatory part, is that sometimes, because you're drawn to it, you do suddenly find out that there is something there, or that there was something there. So that's why I call it dowsing, because it's using every sense in your body to kind of pick up on a landscape. And one of the things that I do that's part of my practice is to leave offerings. So one of the key things for me is that I replace what I've taken. So it's a reciprocal arrangement, if you like. So I generally will pick up seeds or shells or husks or bones or whatever I find, and deposit them in the location close to where I found them. But also sometimes I keep them and take them elsewhere, and they kind of, for me, create invisible lines of energy that connect one place to another. So I'm very big on that, and I do that very privately. It's a personal ritual created in private, and sometimes I speak as I make the offering. And again, it's my way of honouring the landscape that's given me the words, the gift of words. Hopefully that doesn't sound too crazy.
No, not at all. Not to someone like me who has a house full of stones and feathers and shells and all the rest of it.
You and millions of others, you know, yeah. We all do it. We all pick up and collect things. But I do that, but I also like to give them back. I like to return them.
Would you maybe carry stuff around with you then to leave in places?
Yeah, generally I've got the wrong bag with me at the minute, but when I've got my camera with me, in my camera bag there are all sorts of items that I like to deposit here and there and make a small ritual. It's really difficult to explain, but I think it has a history in folk practice, offerings, store attached to trees. It's not anything different from any of that, really. It's a continuum of those kinds of traditions, except for me it's more of a private transaction with the land.
Yeah, it's something, an honouring in a way.
An honouring, definitely an honouring, definitely an appreciation. And these are things that nature has elegantly discarded, and I try to do something poetic and with them. And they'll lie there forgotten, they'll rot down into the soil once again and become parts of the cycle of life,
adding to the layers.
Yeah, definitely. And it's done deliberately for that very reason.
So I'm wondering, Baz, your perception and your way of expressing your connection to landscape, and also the other writers that you've chosen to be part of all of this.
Yeah.
What do you want people to take from this? What's your desire for people to take from this, and the legacy of that?
That's a really interesting question. I think predominantly inspiration, and also recognition of lost places, where we come from, you know, our history, but also acknowledging that there are layers and elements of our history and the places that we dwell in that are completely unknown to us. And then also there's the spiritual dimension, the fact that you can be in an apparently bland and unappealing landscape, and right beneath your feet or in very close proximity to you is an incredible place where humans once dwelled, and that was of huge significance. So it's that sense that you're part of something much bigger.
Thanks very much to Baz Nichols for taking the time to meet with me at Forvie in Aberdeenshire. If you're interested in finding out more about Baz's work and the journal of writing he's developed called Echtrai, that's Echtrai, then take a look at his blog at placefieldnotes.wordpress.com. That's placefieldnotes.wordpress.com. From me, Helen Needham, and Baz Nichols, thanks very much for listening.